Welcome to the Educated Guest Podcast. Thank you for joining us. Caesar, it's been a long time.
I really can't even fuck with you talking to me like that right now.
I'm so ready to do this. I've been waiting all 6 months. How long has it been since we fucking recorded?
Let me just put it like this. We only recorded 8 episodes last year, so we were really off our game the whole last year. Even though the second half was probably really the problem, but...
Unacceptable, and we apologize. And we won't let it happen again.
Don't lie to the people, Rodrigo.
Well, we scheduled the next 3 interviews, so I think we're going to be good.
Okay. We'll shout those out at the end, right?
Yes.
All right.
But today, we have a very special guest. A good friend of ours. Number 9 on the field, but number 1 in our hearts. James Halliday. Yeah, from Arts... National City, A Reason to Survive, Executive Director. You were a writer in your former life. You were...
Wait, I want to back up. Am I a right fielder or am I a pitcher? I'm 9 on the field, but
what
are your hearts?
Man on the field, but your number was number 9.
That's correct.
Is it?
Did you go back and look at the...
I went to Bell's yearbook.
You did not.
I did too.
You know the Bell yearbook, what it's called? Think about the name of the school.
Is it the Trojan or what is it?
Is it Friday?
Huh?
What's the name?
It's called the phone book.
Is it? No way. Is it really called?
Alexander Graham Bell. They call it shit the phone book. Phone book.
I don't remember that. I probably have a Bell Junior High yearbook or two.
You went to Bell, didn't you?
I did.
We call that Bell Middle now. What's up with that?
You know why? Is because if they call it a junior high, then they have to provide electives. I think you know that. But they can get out of that technicality by calling it a middle school.
Whoa. Tell me more again.
It's like you work in a district or something.
I thought junior high means 9th grade isn't included.
Correct. So then they have to offer electives.
Who's this guy?
Oh.
That correction came from...
The third voice.
The superintendent of sound, Ed Nunez.
Welcome. Yes. If you don't know who Ed Nunez is, go listen to the last podcast. It was like we ran it, 6 months ago? Ed Nunez taking care of director of sound...
Did you just call him Ed Nguyen? Is he Vietnamese right now or what?
Nguyen.
Did you catch that?
Ed Nguyen? I said Nunez.
I did live in East San Diego for quite a while.
Nice people call it City Heights. So.
There it goes. There it goes.
So James, you're a superhero. Give us the origin story, man. Where'd you come from?
Born and raised in San Diego.
Uh-huh.
5 generations deep. Mm-hmm. So I grew up in quiet Mission Hills back in the 80s. The 90s, but like we've been talking about, elementary, right on up through middle school, Southeast, Paradise Hills, mm-hmm. San Diego High School, Go Cavers, downtown. Oof. I thought about Division 5 state champions.
Just this last year, but before that, they were complete shit.
Not even this last year, this last month.
Whoa. Yeah. So they just won.
I think the word you're looking for is inconsistent, right?
Well, they were consistently a bad team when I went there.
shout out to the Gamers. Yay.
So we get along really well because we had a similar path. So I went to elementary for a little while in Mission Hills, Grant Elementary.
Oh, yeah.
And then mom shipped me over to Bell because of the magnet program there. Mm-hmm. And then shipped mm-hmm. me over to San Diego because of the IB program. Mm-hmm. Sounds like you might have went on a similar path, sir.
Similar path, yeah.
Yeah.
Now, my parents put me on a bus back in 1986 when I was not quite 6 years old, 5:47.
Mm-hmm.
To go down to Oak Park Elementary.
Okay.
Because they had the gate program.
Uh huh.
And soon after that, they had the music conservatory. So I was playing tuba and trumpet. Tuba and violin from like grade 2. And basically, I was told to play the tuba because as the tallest kid, I was the only one who could
hold the actual instrument.
Hold the damn instrument. So I did that for a couple of years.
So hold on. Did you ever do it?
In elementary school?
No. Did you ever walk behind someone, a teacher maybe that you didn't like, and just walk behind them and go boom,
and just
boom,
wail on them,
boom, 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 boom.
I don't kiss tubas and tell. Boom, 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 boom,
boom. I'm lost. Any teachers from San Diego High? Anybody I might remember?
Stan Murphy.
Oh, yeah. Okay, history teacher.
Stan the man?
Yeah.
Stan the man.
Did not have Mr. Murphy for
11th grade, U.S. history,
yeah.
IB.
Yeah.
Yeah. Stan was there for, if he's listening, I don't know if it's 39 or 40 plus, but it was on for about 40 years. Jeez. At that high school. Mm-hmm. Did legendary things. Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things Stan did with another memorable teacher, she was the IB English teacher, but then like the Writing Academy teacher named Tisha Allen.
Didn't have her.
No.
That's good.
Stan,
I did not have her either. Ed, you? No? Good.
Nope. No, we both went to the same. So he had Murphy.
I know. I know. I'll fuck with you.
I had Scotty.
You missed Scotty.
Yeah.
Okay.
Got it.
So Miss Scotty left San Diego the year before I arrived.
Oh, okay.
So I didn't have her. Miss Karen Robleski?
Yeah, I had Robleski.
So Robo. Mm-hmm. But going back to Mr. Murphy and Miss Allen, they started this thing with at San Diego High School. And this is like this is a little bit of local history about IB schools. You know, IB, once upon a time, was just high schools, right? And there were just a few of them. Mm-hmm. San Diego, Castle Park, and a couple others. Murphy and Allen created this network with IB schools in Argentina, Russia, and Austria. So that students from San Diego High School could do these exchanges. And, you know, they were making asks of families to go out of pocket, but were also like actually finding money, putting money on the table. I don't know. And it was fundraising for the most part.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it was both to do homestays for students from those schools, from those countries, and for San Diego High School students to spend part of a summer in those places.
Okay.
And like, I was able to do that, two of the three summers that I was at San Diego High School. But I tell that now and it's just, I mean, it's almost, you can't even understand that. The idea that there's going to be two high school teachers kind of just freestyling these international partnerships across this IB network and then putting on these fundraisers. And they're not like dipping into school or district dollars, you know? Yeah. It's like,
doing it on their own.
They got their own family. I mean, you know, through the parents, whatever.
No, go ahead. I'm sorry.
And making that happen. It was like, I mean, we'll get to this, but like, you know, my second life, my biggest, you know, huge chapter in my life was all the time I spent internationally, you know, like out of the country. But the tone was set for that. I mean, traveling with family was one thing, but absolutely set by that, by the IB program and by the chance to go to some of those places like Argentina and Austria. When I was young, you know, and like not knowing shit about the world.
Wow. A little jealous that was put together after I left San Diego High, after I left the IB program.
That's cool, man. C's, how was your... Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah, I never left anywhere. I just took those fucking tests and left.
But fuck. Did you have the theory of knowledge class?
Yes. Okay. I was going to ask who taught you TOK.
John Accardo.
Dude, rest in peace. That motherfucker is hardcore. I love that guy.
Do you?
He's one of my favorite teachers of all time.
So, yeah, John was... Mr. Carter was one of the most important influences in my entire life.
And thank you for checking yourself. But he called him John, and then he said, no. I gotta show some respect.
And you'll corroborate this. I mean, we call him John in class.
Absolutely.
And if you were close and you were... I mean, man, help me out here. We should just kind of go back. Like, this dude, he was unlike any teacher anyone has ever had besides him, you know? Like, it wasn't... And the first name is not even the most important thing. He was... So... The briefest of backgrounds on John Accardo is that he taught in, besides teaching at the high school, he spent his summers teaching at the university level in Europe and around the world. And so he brought this mentality, which was sort of this very continental European, but also this blending of like university life, high school life, mm-hmm. into the high school classroom, which wasn't about first name versus Mr. or Mrs. So-and-so,
sure,
right?
Sure.
It was about, it's your choice to show up here, right? Like that. And this is something I'm skipping ahead probably, but like one of the big awakenings, right, that kids have, that transition between high school and college, is they have to be in school, right, for high school.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And the first day get to college, for many young people, they're like, do I have to be? They're negotiating that choice, mm-hmm. versus obligation. And one thing that Accardo kind of set the tone in, even in 10th or 11th grade, typically when you had the TOK class, theory of knowledge class, was that, I mean, you had to be there in a sense, but the entire vibe, the mood he created was that like, this is a choice. You can participate, not participate. But if you do, the amount of like give back and feedback from the teacher and from your students, it's going to nourish you and enrich you in unbelievable ways. So if you choose to show up and share of yourself, it's going to pay you back big time. Mm. And if not, you're not just going to be bored and be like, you know, the uncool person not participating. Mm-hmm. You just won't be nourished. You'll get a bad grade, but like he couldn't give a shit about grades.
Like, he had to submit grades, but that was the least important thing in that dude's. And like, he was explicit about that. It was all about the conversation, the relationships you make in class. If you show up, stand up, and put yourself out there, get vulnerable and express your opinion, like, the grade will follow. Do not worry about that.
That's fucking awesome.
That's Am I right?
Man. That's that man.
Did you feel that?
Absolutely. It was the only negotiation about how you're going to participate in the class was just between you and yourself. That's the way he put it.
The only barrier.
Yeah.
Between whoever you were and whoever the world was then and where the world was going to be the next second was up to you.
No shit.
Yeah, it was like, if you were going to worry about your grade, then you probably weren't going to get the best grade possible. You were going to jump full force, head first into the class, then you would do pretty well.
You know, it's funny because the next year I took an econ class. We were talking about extrinsic and intrinsic motivators.
Yeah.
And you know, the example I gave was John Accardo.
Nice. You're like, he's intrinsic.
Exactly. Grades versus you.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
Get a good grade. And you understand, we all understand the pressure, the fam, all that kind of stuff, the good grades, the college or whatever, all that business, right, about grades and what a grade can do or not do. But it's still, it's so extrinsic, right?
Yeah.
The idea that you can be enriched and that the relationships, like, you're going to feel this warmth, right? Almost immediate feedback by the contributing is so different than whatever the grade might be.
Wow. See, that mall's fucking salty that I never had a theory knowledge class. Like, I took AP classes, but, you know, it's subpar at best.
IB's that weird thing, you know? I mean, it's still... And it's grown, right? I mean, obviously, it's grown internationally. It's grown and here. And now there's the primary years program, middle years program, and high school program, which is great. And more schools are offering it. But back in the day when, you know, we were doing it, it was this really unique thing. And TOK was... You had to do TOK if you wanted the IB diploma.
Oh, no shit. So it was like an anchor class or an anchor, something like that?
If that's the word you want to use. So earlier, in an earlier podcast, we interviewed a teacher by the name of Nikki Eddy at Castle Park, and she happened to be the TOK teacher over there. Like, really inspirational teacher who just drew from her students to build the class. Same shit we're talking about with Mr. Ricardo. So it's just somehow some of these IB programs just find the right teachers to do the classes. I don't know.
It's something, you know, that it's not a subject area specificity, right? Like, you can go through, he's credentialed and all those
processes. All that stuff.
But it's the intangibles, right? Whoever that person is, right? Whether the person you spoke with at Castle Park or John Accardo. It's all the human qualities. It's the frailties, right? It's the imperfections, right? It's all the way. It's asking a teacher to show up with all their warts in class. And like, kind of lay themselves bare in the conversation and make themselves just as much as high school is about, high school is about vulnerability of young people navigating between childhood and adulthood via that weird thing called puberty or whatever.
Yeah.
Like, it was almost like that teacher kind of made themselves whatever the equivalent of pubescent is in terms of like intellectual vulnerability, you know? Ooh. They totally put themselves out
there,
right?
The chameleon them way in there, right?
But also, like, to acknowledge, like, the weakness and then the uncertainty, right? Like, they were not the captain of the classroom, the captain of the ship, knowing all the answers, right? There was this, like, lingering, I don't know, that we had to figure out if it was even possible.
That's fucking rad, dude.
You know, and, like, that just hung there in class and throughout the entire semester, you know, the entire program. I mean, that's, you know, if we were trying to build a theory of knowledge, or at least we were trying to build our own theory of knowledge while understanding different schools. Theories of knowledge, right? That was the point. It wasn't prescriptive. It wasn't this all-knowing teacher, right? It wasn't that the backstop of knowledge and certainty was at that teacher's desk. The teacher's desk was just one more place to start asking questions about what might be.
Oof. So senior year, the choice,
yeah,
and all the other stuff that's wrapped around it. Just give us a little insight to what that experience was like as a senior.
San Diego High. So yeah, I gotta go way back here. I'll tell you what I remember is at the time I was dead set on becoming a doctor, and I was dead set on going to school on the East Coast.
Oh wow, okay.
And I actually this is funny to think about. I haven't thought about this in a long time. I was admitted into the early action program, an 8-year program at Brown, that is a co-terminal undergraduate and medical degree.
Wow.
That and I went back there
I'm listening.
Yeah. And I went back
Ed's judging your elitism, so I'm just I'm watching Ed.
I went back. No, that's real.
So go.
I can see his privilege meter just rising right now.
So you're at Brown, or no, you're not even at Brown. You got accepted to Brown.
Yes, I was in
a co-terminal program.
Yeah,
2 degrees wrapped in one, but 8 years.
8 years.
That makes sense.
Went back there, and I had two experiences on the admission, the admit weekend or whatever. It was cold as hell.
I'm dead set on the East Coast, and it's cold.
And I went to, this is an important subject we're getting onto right now, and I went to a deli that was super close to the campus and had a shitty sandwich. And what you need to know about me is that I'm a sandwich connoisseur.
You are a foodie. You're a serious foodie. You're an absolute foodie.
Serious foodie, and forever have been a sandwich connoisseur. And the idea that it's going to be cold as hell in spring, and all of a sudden my thin skin San Diego-ness came through. I was like, shitty sandwiches in bad weather?
Mm-hmm.
Not doing it.
I was going to roll the dice again.
No, not doing it.
That was the early action thing, and I may very well have done that. You know, would have been obviously a very different life. Mm-hmm. Went back and submitted more applications.
A couple of applications.
And got into Stanford and went up there. And, you know, it was the exact opposite, right? It was like a storybook kind of like silly weekend of on campus. And for, you know, if you go to that campus, it you know, presents pretty well.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
So, and my grandparents went there.
Oh, okay.
So they graduated in 48 and 50 from respectively. So there was this very strong family connection, and I had an incredibly positive experience while I was there. So I'll say that this was in 1999 mm-hmm. that I started school. So mm-hmm. When is that? Like, you know, sort of 98, 99 when I'm kind of thinking about this decision. And it was slightly before Stanford's Silicon Valley. It was just the beginning, you know, kind of at that world. So it certainly wasn't, now we're whatever, 20 years on, basically,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
And so it doesn't, I didn't know the Stanford that people, when they hear that today and what it is today, it didn't have all of those trappings back when I was making the decision. It was for me actually a very deeply personal decision to acknowledge how much of an influence my grandparents were in my life. And so I was like raised as much by my grandparents, the three living grandparents I had, as by my parents. Not that my parents were out of the picture. They were there too. It was just my grandparents all lived within a mile of our house.
Oh,
so right. It was like shared responsibility, along with tons and tons of cousins and stuff. So the idea of like going to that school and carrying on kind of a family legacy, tradition, yeah. a legacy was... And, you know, that word, you know, has a negative connotation in terms of, like, admissions. I understand that, and I've become more and more aware over the years. But back when I was making that decision, it was definitely, I was thinking about my grandparents.
What'd you major in?
History and political science.
Okay.
But there's so we've had this conversation once before where you talked about an educational experience at Stanford that kind of, like, blew you away, and that kind of led into a conversation about what education should be, or at least what a great model of education would be.
Yeah.
So can you share with us this, like, what
that yeah, was yeah. So there's a couple of parts to that. One is when I was trying to make the decision which school to go to, the school that I was most deeply in love with was St. John's College.
Okay.
We've talked about that, yeah.
No, we haven't talked about
that. So that St. John's College, two campuses, in Santa Fe and also in Annapolis, Maryland.
We did.
But it's like a classical, and I mean from the classics kind of curriculum. Great books, classic, multiple languages, theology, like, you know, it's preset, very intensive. And I was absolutely in love with the rigor intensity of that. And one of the most special things about my time at Stanford was I chose to do this year-long track. Every freshman has to do an introduction to humanities, mm-hmm. that kind of Western civ. It's been called a lot of things right over the years. Anyway, mm-hmm. And there was a most of the freshmen chose like what they were going to do their first quarter for that. There was this option, though, to do this thing called Structured Liberal Education, SLE, at Stanford, that was you lived in the same dorm as like half the professors who were going to like be your mentors and teachers. And it was going to be this kind of like very kind of cultish, like go deep thing. And I was like, shit, that's the St. John's thing that I was looking for. Like I was, you know, like as rigorous and kind of intense as possible. And I did it. And it has shaped the rest of my life.
It's okay. Like, when you like, talk about rigor though, what kind of, how, why was it rigorous and what kind of stuff did they do? What stands out about that? Like what?
That you actually had to read. I mean, I was reading close to 1,000 pages a week. I was writing between 20 and 30 pages a week with full feedback from two writing tutors and a full faculty mentor. Jeez. So getting feedback at least every other week, if not once a week. So just and keeping up that reading, writing, thinking pace, you know, and then seminars, you know, 3 days a week. So 2 3-hour sessions 3 days a week, 18 hours of seminar.
That's rigorous.
Incredibly. Yeah, so fun fact, my freshman year, one of my writing tutors was a woman by the name of Chelsea Clinton.
Fun fact. Awesome.
You still never thought of her as a writer.
Never thought of her as a writer. No. Was she a decent writer or was she a good writer?
Very good.
Very good writer.
Very good writer. Very good. Very good feedback. Yeah, she was. She was great.
How would you replicate that at a traditional high school? Because I think that would be dope. But I think also, I don't know if every student is ready to read 1,000 pages and write 20. Like, I don't know. Like, yeah, how can we hack that through and then still get the same?
And so this is in 1999, 2000, right? So, and that's, I mean, another kind of weird thing. It was the total tweener time between generations when I was in school. Absolutely. Like, there was webmail. So was still there.
Yeah.
And it was just that, like, cell phones were not existing, ubiquitous.
Or not, yeah, they weren't ubiquitous, that's true.
Laptops weren't ubiquitous. That whole world that came after us that we can just sort of by shorthand call Silicon Valley, which is appropriate to the university, right? Mm-hmm. Just did not quite exist yet. It was exactly the time when those were like sort of personal luxury goods to ubiquitous technology.
Yeah.
And so living in that small window of time, so we had to read. Mm-hmm. We read and checked out, you know, bought or checked out books. I think the biggest takeaway this is the writing and the feedback and the quality of listening by peers and by tutors and by faculty. The most important thing wasn't the number of pages that you read or wrote. It was the respect and, like, well, you know, use a kind of silly word, horizontality or whatever, the relationship between instructors and learners. Mm-hmm. And there was that somehow we all knew who was who, right? I mean, there's some were very big names in their fields and kind of like, but when we got into those small groups, everyone was learning from each other and it was like, totally candid. And the instructors, because they had such an obligation to provide feedback on huge amounts of writing and what we were doing, we felt that they had as much homework as we did.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Because we were giving them so much and being asked for so much and giving them so much.
But it was reciprocal, right? Like they knew
that reciprocity. They knew. That, yeah.
Okay. So after Stanford, then what happens?
Can't yeah, we'll stay with that thread. I mean, I spent my most of my junior year and a little more than that living in Berlin, you know, study abroad. Wow, okay. So that I think those two threads, right, the writing piece and the living abroad piece, those all foreshadowed what I did afterwards, right, which was after graduating, I moved to Eastern Europe. Mm. And I mean, I graduated in June of 2003. I was living in Krakow, Poland, in July of 2003, and didn't move back to the States on a full-time basis until October of 2014.
And you lived solely in Poland, or you moved around?
3 years in Poland, 3 years in Russia, 2 years in Russia, and then 7 years in Turkey.
And then what were you doing on your travels?
Yeah, so most of that time was initially I was studying. I went and did a graduate degree. I thought I would come back to the States after a couple of years in Poland, because the thing that fascinated me most as an undergrad was how systems were changing in Eastern Europe, kind of before and after the fall of the Berlin Wall, Cold War stuff. Mm-hmm. And I thought, PhD, political science, something like that. But I ended up staying in Poland and getting into writing, pitching stories. So for many years, 8 years, between sort of 2011, was a journalist.
Oh, right on.
Yeah, and so journalism was that was my first career.
Who did you end up writing for? What was the...
Yeah, so in Moscow, I was writing for a culture magazine called Element and doing pieces for the Moscow Times. And similarly in Istanbul, writing for a magazine called Monocle and writing for the Turkish Daily News. So it was writing for like local English language or local press, mm-hmm. and then writing for international magazines.
All right, we're going to take a break here on the Educated Guest podcast. It's your boy ZRF in the house with Mr. _ AYYY. The interview today, of course, is Mr. James Holiday of the Arts Center, Reason to Survive. We hope that you're enjoying it. On this small break, I'd like to share with you who's coming up next. We have local San Diego teacher turned artist teacher, Chicle 79, a.k.a. Enrique Lugo. That's a hot one. It'll be coming up very soon. We're trying to crank out more episodes this year with the help of our boy, the superintendent of sound, Mr. Ed Nunez. We're going to jump back into this interview. Let's hear what James got to say. James Holiday, Educated Guest Podcast. Peace. Welcome back. Episode 35 of the Educated Guest Podcast. It's your boy Caesar Does It, your man, Mr. _AYYY. But we're sitting here with an important man by the name of James Holiday. James, we need to talk about where you work. We don't need to talk about what you do. The center. Talk to us, man.
Yeah. Arts, A Reason to Survive, National City.
Mm-hmm. How do you fall into that job?
I started there a year ago this week.
Oh. Oh,
right on. Yeah, Arts had gone through a rocky transition this is a nonprofit tale right here. It's often the case that there's a founder who starts an organization, you know, and runs it for however long. And in the case of Arts, it was the founding director ran it for a good 15 years. And it was very, it was his personal story that the organization kind of came from. And then it moved a bunch of places and ended up in National City 6 years ago, 2012.
Mm-hmm.
So when I took over at the beginning of 2018, the organization had basically almost gone under. It had hired a second executive director in the middle of 2017. There was a lot of kind of reckoning with where things were at, like as an organization, finances, board, all that stuff, you know? And there was this point where their question came up was like, does this organization need to be? Does it need to?
Wow, you're there.
Does
huh?
it even need to survive? And the founding director kind of jumped back in, and the board at the time did, and some community members, and they said, "Yo, we want to give this one last run to see if there's a there, because the transition from a founder to the second is always the most difficult thing, and you know, there's a good percentage of them don't even make it through, but if you get to a third, if you do that, then you make this important transition from the personal story of the founder and like the organization as an extension of that founder's personality and own story,
mm-hmm.
into a new chapter of things where there's a leader who is going to shape an organization separate from its origin. So that's the role that I have been in for the last year. So I was, before I took on this job, I was working for... This organization called LRNG. It was a MacArthur Foundation funded initiative looking at how do you credential all kinds of learning in the out of school space. So, and I was the Western Regional. It was a national organization. I oversaw the Western Region. It was four cities in California, and I worked mainly with libraries, museums, and all kinds of community organizations to understand how it's possible to to capture the learning taking place for young people, kind of elementary right on up through transitioning age youth, in the out of school space. It was really exciting, very kind of wonky, very specific, right? Like, but it was asking this big question for me. It asked this big question, which is, how are we? What is the overall experience the young people are having of learning mm-hmm. in school versus all the learning that happens out of school? And it was I'd never been in focus as a question to ask until I took on this job with LRNG, but. When this opportunity to take over at Arts came to me, it really informed my my outlook on the position, on the organization, and the opportunity. Because the organization Arts has been like an after school arts education provider for a long time, mm-hmm. but it never really had any like deep relationships with school districts and thinking about that whole continuum of learning, right, from the in school to the out of school, and how. As an organization and with teaching artists and with programs, it can be this complementary learning space. So I came at it from this kind of very geeky, like kind of school education approach to an organization that had always been kind of like this standalone community arts org. And that's, I think, what we're trying to figure out right now. That's how can we... And actually, I just came from a conversation with our whole team, which is what are the big goals we're going to set for ourselves for the next year and beyond? And, you know, one of those is with elementary age students, for example, is how can we want to be able to have every elementary student in the National School District, for example, K-6 district serving just National City. How can every student in that school district have a creative experience with arts at the Arts Center? As a community arts organization. And then we said for the secondary age students, you know, so middle school and high school students, many of them in the Sweetwater District, you know, how can we have a creative example that points toward an opportunity in the creative workforce in San Diego?
That's right.
And so we're thinking about the building blocks of creativity and those formative experiences for primary age youth. And we're thinking about, how do we create a local pipeline into the creative industries, into the creative economy for secondary age youth? And then how can we be, as an organization, as a space, as a team, as a .. how can we be a catalyst for that, right? How can we be a great community partner for youth, parents, families, school districts, anyone that we need to be in order that young people are accessing those opportunities at whatever age they're at?
Yeah, when I think about all the ways that students can have an entry point into arts, there's just multiple entry points from my perspective, right? One of the ways that I think about your center is, you know, there's a kid out there who is artistically challenged but has never thought of being an artist as a profession. So if they can go to your center and create beautiful things and at the same time work with somebody who's actually getting paid to create art, then that opens up that avenue for them. I mean, that's just one.
You know, and also it just expands when they're at the center and when they're having conversations with actual practitioners, people doing it on the ground. Their entire notion of what art is, what the arts are, it just explodes infinitely, right? Because it goes from thinking that art, lowercase a, is this small thing that you do when you're a kid, right? It's finger painting and watercolors and just kind of messing around.
Mm-hmm.
To think about the arts and you know, I think also just the skills, competencies around creativity as the most sought after skills by in any job you'd ever want to do, any profession you ever want to enter into. And for the arts specifically, I think we can then, you start seeing like, you know, folks working in what I call the creative economy or creative industries, you know, it's guys like mixing sound, you know, it's folks who are doing event production. It's folks doing graphic design, product design, you know, UX. This the entire gamut of jobs out there. And, you know, many of them are new that didn't even maybe exist a year, 5 years ago, right? And so that's one of these things about the creative economy, that when young people are coming up, whether they're seeing what like their parents do, cousins do, learning from their teachers, if this is an older generation trying to tell young people what's out there for them, it's often the case that the older generation doesn't really know what these jobs are.
Has happened or where
because it's at. Because these jobs, these job titles, these professions, these opportunities are like almost they're materializing like instantaneously before our eyes. You know,
wasn't there someone who I think so there was someone over at Hideka that we were working with that they were looking at they were teaching the students how to take care of all the run the software that was controlling all the lights that were in the theater. And so one professional comes into the school and says, like, just gives a quick tutorial about how they're going to use the space. But at the end of the day, he's like, if any of you guys are really seriously interested in this, like, and you guys get proficient doing this, I need people working all the time. And, like, that to me was just, like, exactly what you're talking about. It's something that I would never think of. It's not, like, a traditional job that you would think of as a... Like, oh, guess what? I'm going to be a lighting engineer.
Right.
That's not...
AV tech.
Yeah, there you go. So.
I mean, think about, you know, I mean, San Diego region, tourism, right, is one of the...
Yep.
One of the biggest industries, sort of non-military, non-governmental, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you think about all the ways in which a city or a region needs to communicate itself, not just to, like, the country anymore, but now to the world, right? And that is all about... you know, having savvy communicators using all forms and technologies and platforms available to them, right? These are going to be the young people coming up who may not excel in traditional ways with grades and across all the classes, absolutely. Right? It's going to be those young people who are taking risks to, like, you know, kind of create their own language, create their own style, right? Get their voice out there in whatever form it has, and they're going to find those adults, those professionals, when they're looking for jobs, if they're lucky, right? If they're put in the way of opportunity, which is what, you know, folks like us here around the table, like, you know, hopefully we at Arts can do, is put young people in the way of opportunity so that they can be discovered, to have that voice, that but also that courage.
That's what it is, dude.
You know, to not only tell their story, and by telling their story, they're telling the story of where they're from. You know, they're telling the story of their city, community, etc., right? Because that's in so many ways what the world is about today, right? It's about not having someone tell your story for you. It's about telling it yourself.
Your own story, yeah.
Right? And collectively, the stories being told is the story and the history and the layers of the region and communities we come from. Mm-hmm. And you know, through the arts, whether that's visual, whether that's like digital media arts, whether that's, you know, even, you know, social media and YouTubers, whether that's music,
creating their content, man.
Right? They are creating their own content, and it's the quality and consistency of content. That's the thing you say. We got some unbelievably talented people, but if you can't produce that good shit, like, on the regular,
yeah, it's not
like, yeah. If you're just a flash in the pan, one and done, like, okay, anyone can do that once, you know. But I think if you're trying to, like, translate that into a career, it's the consistency of output, and then that's the rigor we were talking about earlier. That's the work ethic we're talking about earlier. That's becoming. That's the adulting. Like, that regular,
it's doing the cool shit. Doing the cool shit is like what adolescents would do, right? And that's what drives them in.
Oh yeah.
But the adulting is the grind, like
showing up,
produce, day in, day out, ship it.
Listen, put up with the shit. You know, be patient. Don't react emotionally and walk away and all this kind of stuff. You know, that's what you grow out of.
Does the center have any trouble finding teaching artists? Because I would imagine there's a difference between, you know, just a really good artist and somebody who can actually, like, teach people.
Yeah, I think that's, again, my own bias was that I was looking for professional artists who did have a sense of teaching, right?
Mm-hmm.
They didn't need to be credentialed teachers. That's not a requirement. But they do know how to, like, manage, you know, manage kids. They need, like, how to structure a lesson or design a project or a program.
Mm-hmm.
It's not for everyone, right? There are many talented artists who certainly are not very good teachers, nor maybe not, haven't been asked to be. And there are some great teachers that in the arts that aren't particularly great good artists. So it's threading a needle there.
Mm-hmm.
No, I think. But what you do find when you start talking with this group of professional teaching artists is that they're a pretty tight knit community.
Okay.
And if you're tapped into some good ones, especially if they've got loyalty to an organization, to a mission, they're going to reach out to their own, you know,
mm-hmm.
and be like,
mm-hmm.
you should jump in here, you know?
Okay.
This person who's at the helm or this group, this community is a good fit.
Okay. Yeah, and that was pretty much my follow-up is like, what kind of networks do you have to move through to find these people? Or sometimes they just find you, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, that's... I mean, every day I thank my team because, I mean, no one does anything great alone. And you know, like I said, I'm a year in. I inherited some folks who've been at the organization for a while, and the folks who stayed around and who I asked to come back are just amazing. And two of those, three are phenomenally talented teaching artists, mm-hmm. with their own networks, and they don't even like think about like the richness of their network. You know, they just think about what they just do their thing.
Okay.
But when I was asking that same question, right? I was like, how can we expand? How can we like, you know, get a deep bench here? You know, let's make this an all-star team. Mm-hmm. Like, who do you want to call in? They started making some calls for some special projects we did with some workshops we offered, and some of the folks who showed up was like, oh shit, like, you know, the right people.
There you go. Mm-hmm. You brought up a couple you said it a couple times, community, and I know that you guys do a lot of work with the community, with National City. How important is like involving either the community in your work, or how, I mean, what's your take on involving the community for a context to learn?
Yeah, I think it's the best canvas for learning that I can think of. Maybe especially in our case where, you know, we're a community arts organization. I'm particularly mindful of the fact that it was a city and a community that invited arts as an organization to be in the space that we're in. That happened years ago, well before I came. But there's a for the variety of reasons we were asked to you know, sort of take on, to, you know, get into the space we're in now. I'm thankful that the organization was given the opportunity to be in like 20,000 something square feet of an amazing space.
Huge, and it's awesome,
right? And you've seen what I've seen is that the different folks in the organization, what they've done with it in terms of just the way it's been, you know, sort of kitted out and designed, and like, you know, it's a one of a kind space, you know, in our region. And so I think of that as like, that's a gift that I have, and it's my responsibility to do everything I possibly can to open those doors wide, and not just invite, you know, more and more young people in for our programs, but it's really to make it, to triple underline the community and community art center, so that you know, more and more local artists, performers, community members, parents, volunteers can get not only to know our work, but are able to access like that space and that as a resource, so that they can deepen whatever their work is, their cultural practice, and enrich, I think, the connections in community. I mean, as an organization and then individually as a leader, you know, I call myself a conduit, right? Mm. I'm like a conduit for others to, you know, to get to where they want to go in terms of, you know, whether that's professional advancement opportunity, community members to like, you know, have a meeting, create a piece of art, realize whatever they're trying to do. I mean, that's in some ways all I can do and what I'm supposed to do. That's why, you know, that's in many ways why nonprofits are there, right? It's to fill a market gap, and for many people, a free or very, you know, a very affordable space to explore art, culture, design, cultural identity. You know, this is not something that's available to many folks.
Yeah, yeah. It's reinforcing that creating of that third space for the community, right? Not necessarily work or home, but it's this third space where traditionally it could be churches or community centers or things like that, or bars or parks or whatever, but really creating a third space for people to create their own identities. Do you have, I'm just curious, because I'm really, are there any other things that you guys need, or like, What's a particular problem that you guys are working on that maybe some of our listeners or just people would like to hear about, or things that maybe that we could help out with? You know, what's something that you guys are trying to tackle?
Yeah, I think I'd say one of our biggest challenges right now is I was mentioning the transitions, is we're trying to like tell our story anew. You know, I think we've been known for a lot of things over the years and a lot of places. And I think what we want to do right now is connect with the right folks in the community, local artists, influencers, whomever, that want to take an interest in what we're doing, want to take an interest in the young people that we're serving, mm-hmm. And join in and be part of that process of teaching, learning, and providing them opportunities to do whatever they want to do next. And so I think that's a big ask. So all those technical tools and abilities to storytell, and then making those stories real for the young people. That's the biggest ask.
So people need to get in there. They need to get into your space, use it.
They need to use it in a variety of ways, right? Whether they're, you know, again, as whether that's everything from a volunteer to a board member to a funder to a performer. There's all kinds of ways to engage.
Nice. Mm. So how can they find you? Where can they get more information on not just, because I'm sure people want it, the James Bond of the out of school world. That's who we're going to call James Halliday. He's the James Bond of after school, having 19 different passports and shit. The question though is, where can we find you, like Carmen San Diego, and then how can we learn more about arts? Right before we pivot into the next segment of the show, where we start talking about music and your musical history.
AReasonToSurvive.org, Instagram @A2Survive, Facebook, all the good places.
Okay.
Yeah, you know, you can put my contacts in the show notes if you want.
Sweet. We'll be right back, because I want to ask your top five MCs, and I want to find out what kind of music gets you in the mood.
Back from our breaks, folks. Episode 35, Educated Guest Podcast. We're here with James Halliday. We're about to wrap this up. Rodrigo, you wanted to ask him something really important, something deep, profound.
I need to know his top five MCs. Oh. And so we've go through this. Like, there are several iterations of this question. You can either do top five MCs, or you can do top five groups. But I kind of want to know top five MCs. That's kind of a thing for us.
There are no wrong answers, but there are terrible answers.
And there's just no judgment, just a lot of it. Do you have a list of five MCs that you feel, and we don't even have to say in order?
Pete Seeger,
shy girl.
And you know what? Get your phone ready, because if he says some MC that you and I are not familiar with, we're gonna have to play something.
I'm gonna Google search him, and then I'm gonna fucking figure it all out. So here we go. We've only done
Eastern European.
We're not gonna get a cease and desist letter for his obscure ones.
Not true. Maybe we can watch it be the one. Don't jinx it.
That's how the Fugees got popped.
Yeah, exactly. It is how the Fugees got popped. Sir, top five. No particular order.
Yeah, so I'm at four right now, and I want to, like, we'll talk about these, whip through these. You'll give me the flack, you'll give me the approval, and then I'll come up with the fifth after that, right?
Sounds good. First one.
Tretch, Naughty by Nature.
Ooh. Tretch.
Awesome MC.
Naughty by Nature.
Tariq Trotter.
The Roots.
Dizzy Rascal out of the UK.
Not familiar with the name, but not the work.
Oh, you got to listen to Diz.
Dizzy Rascal?
Yeah, so here we go. Also Wiley. Wiley's his prodigy. You know Wiley?
No. Dizzy Rascal only. No? Ed's shaking his head no. Ed produces hip-hop music. He doesn't know what you're talking about. The
original. This is grime. I mean, you know, like...
Grime.
I don't know what that means.
Like necro? Grime?
Whoa.
So this is Dizzy Rascal. D-I-Z-Z-E-E Rascal. Born in the Corner is the name of
my tracks
hour.
Before I can.
And the name of the song is called Stop That.
Yeah.
What's going on, Caesar? Where is this guy from?
East London.
East London?
And he needs to play at high volume.
I really like the beat. I actually do. I really like the beat.
You don't like that screamy kind of weirdness?
Nah, it's like stripper fight music. I can't really, get into it. You know what I'm saying?
I caught that he was from East London. Just a little bit of the accent.
Yeah, I should have done a better job of like picking out a single, but I'm on the spot here.
No, you're good.
There's, let me go top of the drop. What?
So I'll give you two more. One is
we get a bonus one?
Yeah, you get a bonus one.
Okay.
Because right. I got to throw a little more international flavor. But I'm gonna bring it back home for the fifth.
I like it.
Which is Missy.
Okay,
I'll take it. I think Missy. She has made a couple appearances. A couple people like Missy. Go ahead.
Love Missy. Always have.
I think she.
What
has,
what about old girl at the barbecue?
The brat.
Elderly lady singing Missy Elliott.
She went viral.
I didn't see it.
Yeah, you did.
Nah.
You saw that. So cue it up. Yeah. Homegirl, she's doing karaoke. She's saying the whole, is it work? Get when you work. Get and the now. Whoop it. And so she just knew the whole thing.
And she's an older woman.
Older white lady. And she's doing her thing. Oh. Our barbecue. Oh, just okay. Doing her thing. And everybody's okay. Like, what? It was awesome. She just hit it word for word. She did. She nailed it.
I'm gonna have to watch that.
It's real. And there's someone who walks in the background. Some old homegirl. She has a little plate of food. She's like this. Yeah, just vibing. I'm like, okay, gotcha.
I'm gonna check that out.
It's good.
All right. Where else are we going?
So where was four? Where was five that you're gonna bring home back for?
Yeah, the other. You know, I'm just thinking of my sister-in-law just gave birth, and I was thinking about this morning, and this name just popped in my head, which is they're out of South Africa. They're called the Antwoord, which means the answer.
I think they're working with DJ Muggs from Cypress Hill.
And there's this track called I Think You Freaky. So DJ Ninja is the main MC, and then Yolanda is the girl.
Playing it at volume. This is definitely a European thing, right? So wait, you said that these fuckers are producing now, working with DJ Muggs?
I want to hear that shit, because this shit right here is not hip-hop.
Yeah, I think that Muggs is just using them as the
beat.
The rappers. He's doing the production.
Okay, yeah. Okay.
So I wanted to bring some a little diversity.
I got you.
Into Caesar's ear.
I appreciate that.
Look, he goes, I don't even know what the fuck that was.
Everything we do is an attempt.
He's like, we make some mistakes with our guests. 35.
So, hey, you know what? I'll tell you this much. No. I'll tell you this much. I'll say, hey, the Tretch from Naughty by Nature was a white Tretch.
Because he's a dope fucking MC.
I'm just going to say, but why? I mean, you're going to put Tretch. See, I didn't hear any kind of semblance of like. There's no Nas, there was no Rakim, there was no nothing.
I didn't try to reach for the
pinnacles.
The pinnacles, yeah. I think Feel Me Flow is one of my favorite tracks. Like it was like a lesser tier A track, you know.
He's able to get so many words in.
So many words. And I feel like when I listen to him, I feel like he can be nasty and like he's a big dude. But I feel like he's always smiling big
yes,
when he spits, you know? I feel like he has this big grin on his face. He's so eager to spit it. You know? And it's always like, and maybe it's that one song, but like, it's like the most sunny day. It's a combination of a sunny day and a talented MC.
I'll take that.
So nice.
Any parting words, my friend? I think we're getting to this point where in the show where we're getting ready to leave. And any last asks for our listeners? Any things you want to part us out on? Any parting words? That's
what call to action.
Any call to action? There you go.
What's the youngest person you had on this podcast?
The youngest person we've had on this podcast,
Dr. Dan. He's 31.
That's a good call. Yeah, I would have said Dr.
Just
Dan.
Got his doctorate. Yeah.
Why? What's up?
Oh, just, you know, might be fun to have some youth voice on here. Like,
fuck, oh. Are you serious?
I mentioned that early. That. He didn't like the idea.
There he goes. It didn't work with
dude,
the format.
I mentioned that in like episode 3 or 4. He's,
Not true. Who, okay, so you want, if we get someone young, who here's the call to action for you then, I guess. Who else should we have on the show? You said young people, but who else?
Well, there's a couple of people you should talk to. One dude's called Nate Howard. You should talk to Nate.
Nate Howard.
Yeah. From Movement B.
Okay.
And then please. This dude called Derek
Write it
Hodges.
Down. Write it down, Ed. Please help us out.
And this guy called Derek Hodges, D-A-I-R-R-I-C-K. Derek okay. Hodges.
Okay.
Okay, so why are you nominating these two people to be on the podcast?
So, I mean, just cueing off of Youth Voice, I mean, these are some leaders right now in our community who are, they're not educators in the formal sense of being classroom teachers,
uh-huh.
but they are working with some unbelievable young people on through performance, voice, public speaking, hip-hop, spoken word. I think you'd enjoy the conversations.
Oh, my goodness. Can we record that one at the Art Center? Oh,
absolutely.
Let's do it. Can, I'm
looking
down.
Forward to that.
Fuck with that. Yeah. If you promise to help us, can we link that up? Can we do that?
Say the word.
Mockingbird.
All right, as we head out, give us again, what's the website for the organization?
reasontosurvive.org.
Gotcha.
And then on all them Instagram, all the socials.
All them IGs, all them FBs.
Yeah. Okay. What is it? A reason, and then number 2.
A reason to survive.
Okay.
Spelled out on the Facebook. And then a reason, the number 2, survive on the IG.
And are
IG.
You currently looking for any specific kind of artist? Are you good?
Yeah, no, digital media artists right now. Documentary, like filmmakers.
Okay.
Digital storytellers.
Okay.
Ooh. What if we found you a partnership with students doing the digital storytelling?
Yes.
Okay, let's work on that.
Bring it on.
Ed, anything else? You're the boss, applesauce. I'm just the talent.
The board.
No.
The chairman of the board.
C-SPAN has like an annual
competition.
Competition, right? Yep. Yeah, just starting to do it with some of my students, but... Speaking of, you know, documenting stuff, it's a pretty cool little thing they got going.
All right. Alrighty, the superintendent of sound, Ed Nunez.
That's it.
The chairman of the board.
Thank you. Thank
Caesar,
you for your time.
Caesar does it on them Twitters.
Caesar does it on them Twitters.
Thank you so much. You were not half bad.
Taking it out.